Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Martin Kiernan. I'm speaking to you from the UK, where I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the second teleclass organized by Weber Training for 2011, the 10th anniversary year. Today's teleclass is sponsored generously by Deb Limited, and it's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Anjum Chagpar to you. Anjum is the manager of the Healthcare Human Factors Group, also a founding member of the group. She has 10 years' experience designing, building, and evaluating medical devices and health technology information using user-centered methods. She works at the Centre for Global eHealth Innovation at the University of Toronto. And today's session is entitled A Human Factors Approach to Hand Hygiene. Welcome, Anjum.
Thank you very much, Martin. My presentation today will describe a project we worked on about a year and a half ago here at the University Health Network in Toronto, where we attempted to take a somewhat alternative and complementary approach to improving hand hygiene compliance through the application of human factors principles and methods. So before I get into the details of the project, I'll be talking a little bit about human factors to give you a sense of what it is and how we use it towards our goal of improving healthcare systems. And when I say systems, I'm referring to the environments in which healthcare is delivered, the processes that we use to deliver healthcare, and the tools and technologies that we use as well. So moving on to my next slide, the session goals, today we'll be talking, as I mentioned, about human factors and its application in healthcare. And then I'll describe the approach that we took to address what we see as poor hand hygiene compliance using human factors. And then I'll talk briefly about a toolkit that we've developed to help healthcare workers and their institutions address these barriers to hand hygiene. So moving on to the third slide, I'd like to start by talking about human factors by telling you a story. So this is a picture of Denise Melanson. She's a 43-year-old woman from Nova Scotia, and she was living in Rainbow Lake, Alberta, here in Canada. She was a teacher and the mother of three teenage boys. And she had nasopharyngeal cancer, fourth slide. And she was, the nasopharynx is the area where the nose meets the throat, as you see on this slide. So she was scheduled to receive chemotherapy, and the treatment was expected to be effective. Next slide. So this is the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton where she was receiving her treatment. And on the morning of July 31st, 2006, Denise went to the medical bay unit at the Cross to receive her second round of outpatient chemotherapy treatment. Next slide. At 9:30 in the morning, she was given several IV pre-medications, and these were used to prevent the side effects of chemotherapy. And she was also given a chemotherapy drug called cisplatin and then some post-hydration. And all of this was part of her chemotherapy protocol, and it took about 5 hours to complete this treatment. Next slide. So the final part of her chemotherapy regimen was a drug called fluorouracil, and this medication was to be given over 4 days. And thanks to advances in technology, Denise would be allowed to go home and carry on with her regular activities as the drug infused via this pump that she would carry around in a small fanny pack around her waist. So Denise's nurse prepared the medication, the fluorouracil, and programmed the infusion pump. She actually asked a second nurse to check her calculations and pump programming before starting the infusion. And after this, Denise's nurse reviewed the pump functionality with her and told her that she should come back in 4 days when the pump would be disconnected. So Denise left the Cross Cancer Institute at around 2:30 p.m. that day. And at about 6:30, she noticed that her pump was beeping. And when she opened the fanny pack, she saw that the fluorouracil bag was empty. She had been given 4 days' worth of chemotherapy in 4 hours. And as we know, chemotherapy is highly cytotoxic. So next slide. Denise actually died 3 weeks after that overdose of massive organ failure. And she was only 43. Next slide. But she wasn't alone. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine in the United States reported that 44 to 98,000 people die every year due to preventable medical errors. That's more people than those that die from AIDS, breast cancer, and car accidents in the United States combined. In Canada, we have similar numbers. The news isn't any better. In fact, on a per capita basis, it's worse. And these sorts of retrospective chart reviews to identify preventable patient deaths have been done the world over, and the numbers are all fairly similar and similarly grim. And what's worse is in the 10 years since the original IOM report, the numbers haven't changed much. Next slide. So what's happening? This is actually the order for Denise's chemotherapy. And you can see that it states that the total dose to be delivered over 4 days is 5,250 milligrams. Next slide. So what Denise's nurse needed to do was to use the order to calculate the rate to program the pump with. So she needed to convert the milligrams over 4 days into milliliters per hour. She actually didn't have a calculator, so she performed this calculation by hand. First, she converted the dose over 4 days into the dose per day by dividing by 4. Next, she converted the dose per day into the dose by per hour dividing by 24. And then finally, she converted the dose per hour into the rate per hour dividing by the concentration. And the concentration actually was listed on the chemotherapy bag, not the pharmacy order. Except what happened was she missed the second step. Her colleague who double-checked her work also came up with the same rate. So she ended up programming the pump with a rate of 28.8 milliliters per hour, a 24-fold overdose. Next slide. If we look at this slide, this is the actual chemotherapy bag and the actual label on that bag that was delivered to Denise. And you can see it's circled right there that the 1.2 milliliter per hour rate is labeled on the bag. Yeah, there was a lot of information on this bag, but that number was there. So how could that have been missed? And was, in fact, Denise's nurse to blame for that error? We'll move to the next slide. One of the things that we use, one of the models that we use to determine whether somebody is culpable in healthcare is this model here, adapted from James Reason, a cognitive psychologist who practices in the UK. And it has four tests. The first is the deliberate harm test. So we can ask ourselves, were the actions as intended? Did Denise's nurse intend to give her a 24-fold overdose? Well, the answer is no. Was she incapacitated? Was there evidence of ill health or substance abuse? Now, we know that there wasn't, because the Institute of Safe Medication Practice actually did a retrospective root cause analysis on this incident and found that, no, she was healthy and she wasn't abusing substances. And then the third test is the foresight test. So did Denise's nurse depart from agreed-upon protocols or safe procedures? Well, we know she adhered to the protocol of recalculating recalculating the dose and the rate to program the pump with, and also the procedure of having that work double-checked. So she did actually adhere to protocols and procedures. So the final test is a substitution test. Would another individual have behaved the same in similar circumstances? And what we know, again, from the ISMP root cause analysis, is that they actually asked six nurses to program the same pump that Denise's nurse programmed with the same order. And of those six nurses, one made the exact same mistake. They programmed the pump with a 28.8 milliliter per hour rate. So, in fact, when we think about this case, all of these tests, the deliberate harm test, the incapacity test, the foresight test, and the substitution test, all of those are essentially passed, and then it becomes an issue of not the individual, but the system. And so this is actually, next slide, quite contrary to our traditional approach to fallibility in healthcare, where we tend to blame the individual because perhaps they were morally weak in some way, they weren't paying attention, or they were forgetful. Next slide. But in human factors, we know that people have inherent limitations. For example, we get tired. If we're working for more than 21 hours without sleep, our performance is equivalent to someone who is legally intoxicated. We wouldn't be able to drive if we were working without sleep for 21 hours, and yet we're expected to work in healthcare. Our memories are limited. We can only hold 7 ± 2 chunks of information at any one time without memory aids, such as repetition lists, or reminders. So if we're not writing things down or if we're not repeating things, that 7 ± 2 chunks of information is gone in about 15 seconds. We also have a limited amount of attention resources. The more attention we're paying to one thing, the less we have to pay to other things. And finally, as people, as humans, we have a lot of biases. And I'm going to talk about one of them on this next slide called the framing effect. Our decisions are highly influenced by these biases. And in a study that was done here at the University of Toronto by Rettelmeyer and Shafir, two groups of physicians were given a very similar case and asked about how they would proceed. The first group was told that they had a 67-year-old patient with chronic hip pain, and nothing was working for him. So the decision was made to send this patient for hip replacement surgery. And in the case, the situation is that a couple of days before the surgery, you, the physician, are reviewing your charts and you realize that there was something that you didn't try. You didn't try ibuprofen. So the question put to this group of physicians is, what would you do? Do you cancel the surgery and try ibuprofen, or do you let the patient continue on to surgery? And the good news is that the majority of physicians in this group said they would cancel the surgery and ask the patient to try ibuprofen. Now, the second group of doctors were given a very similar case. They were told that they had a 67-year-old patient with chronic hip pain. Nothing was working, so he's scheduled for surgery. This time, a couple of days before the surgery, as you're reviewing the patient's chart, you notice that there are two things that you didn't try. You didn't try ibuprofen, but you also didn't try piroxicam. So the question is put to the physicians, what would you do? Do you let the patient continue on to surgery, or do you call them back? And if you cancel the surgery and decide to try ibuprofen or piroxicam, which do you try first? Now, in this group, the majority of doctors actually said that they would let the patient continue on to surgery. So what's interesting is that the basic question, the fundamental question, is the same. Would you allow your patient to continue on to surgery when there was an alternative, non-surgical, less invasive potential solution? And it's just the presentation of the information that changes that outcome, that decision. So this has an obvious implication for how we design healthcare systems, specifically information systems, when we're thinking about how to present data, because that data can influence decisions in striking ways, in sometimes unpredictable ways. There are other biases that we have. For example, next slide, confirmation bias. So a confirmation bias is the tendency to seek out information that confirms our preconceptions. So if we believe something is right, we're going to look for evidence that that is right. And when we see when we find that evidence, or what we think is that evidence, it confirms our biases or our thinking. Moving on, we have something called in-group bias. This is a type of social bias where we believe that those that are like us are good. They're more competent, they're moral, and those that are dissimilar to us, those that are unfamiliar to us, maybe aren't as good or less good. Moving on, we also have something called omission bias, which is the tendency to do nothing rather than to do something that may potentially be harmful. And you might think about a situation that you've been in where, you know, you weren't sure if an action could potentially help the situation or potentially escalate the situation, make something worse. And so your tendency may have been to just do nothing. That's the omission bias that we're all sort of subject to. And finally, the last bias that I'm going to talk about, we have many more, is this posterior probability error, where we tend to believe that things will happen as they happened in the past. So that outcomes, if they were positive in the past, will be positive in the future. If things go well, they will continue to go well. So moving on to the next slide, now that we have all of this human factors perspective, if we look at the Denise Melanson case again, we can see that there were probably a lot of human limitations at play here. And ISMP did, in fact, find a number of contributing factors. Firstly, there were actually two pumps used on that chemo floor, one that was programmed with an hourly rate, but one that was programmed with a 24-hour rate. So when Denise's nurse came up with that number, 28.8, it was actually a rate that she had programmed previously into one of the 24-hour rate pumps. So there was a confirmation bias there. She saw that number, 28.8, and she had seen it before, and so it was familiar, and she believed that that was the right rate. There was probably also an in-group social bias at play here, because the second nurse who double-checked Denise's work also found that her calculation was correct. So she may have been thinking that Denise's nurse was, you know, potentially somebody that she had worked with for a long time, was a competent person like herself, and was less able to detect the error as a result. And as you can see, the label itself was quite confusing. It had lots of information on it, and you can imagine would require a large amount of attention to be paid to understand all the data on it. And healthcare, as we know, is fraught with interruptions, so there could have been a loss of attention there that led to a misreading of the label. If we move on, we can also look at the design of the technology as a contributing factor. This is the pump that needed to be programmed in milliliters per hour, but you can see that there is no such option. There's milligrams per milliliter, micrograms per milliliter, and then milliliters. And so the user had to know to choose milliliter, after which they would be presented with several additional options. But there's another problem with this pump, and that's that the decimal button, which is critical in supporting data entry, is also used to scroll up. So you can imagine that somebody might be thinking that they were scrolling up, but then inadvertently entering a decimal button, or vice versa. And this could have implications on a overdose or underdose. We move on to the next slide, we'll see that there are, in fact, potentially a lot of mistakes waiting to happen just with this one case, but in healthcare in general. And so, again, James Reason has modeled healthcare as this Swiss cheese model, where each subsystem in the healthcare system is seen as a slice of Swiss cheese with holes in it or weaknesses in it. And so when we have an error, for example, a label that's difficult to read, a pump that's difficult to program, an environment that's fraught with interruptions, all of these potential weaknesses can line up and cause a hazard to actually become a loss. So the basic premise of human factors is that humans are fallible and errors are to be expected. And so what we need to do is design countermeasures that can tolerate the occurrence of error and contain their damaging effects. So essentially, we know that we can't change the human condition, but what we want to do is change the condition under which humans work. Move on to the next slide. So how do we do that? How do we design more error-tolerant systems? Well, one approach in human factors is through the application of user-centered design, which, as the name implies, is centered on the user. And at every phase in the planning, research, design, or refinement or validation of a design, users are involved. And this is the approach that we use to develop our hand hygiene toolkit, and I'll talk more about that shortly. But just to give you some examples of what each of these activities involve, in the research phase, for example, if you move to the next slide, you'll see often what we do is we'll go out into the environment of care where the end users are working to understand what that's like, what the context of work is like, what's the environment like, what's the communication like, what's the space like, what are the tools that are being used, etc. And this is a very powerful but simple research technique that leads to insights into workplace culture and workarounds and coping mechanisms. So what we're looking at here is a keyboard and mouse that we found while we were shadowing pharmacists in a unit that had just implemented computerized physician order entry. And as a result of the design of this CPOE system, this physician order entry system, and the fact that doctors hadn't previously been writing orders, most of them were verbal, and they now had to enter these orders electronically, pharmacists, as a result of all of this, were constantly correcting orders, so much so that the number of keystrokes they performed during a shift increased by 300%. This left 40% of our staff on modified leave due to repetitive strain injuries, such as carpal tunnel syndrome. This keyboard and mouse actually belonged to a pharmacist who had exhausted both her short-term and her long-term leave and wanted to continue working so badly, in fact, that she used Lego blocks, the red and white blocks there, on the Control, Alt, Shift, Tab, and shortcut keys so that she could manipulate the software with her feet as much as possible. So again, I think what's remarkable about a slide like this or a picture like this is it tells so much more about the culture, about the motivations of the people in that environment, how they work, etc. So once we understand the environment through this sort of ethnography and in-context observation, move on to the next slide, we will typically design prototypes, prototypical solutions. So this is an example of an infusion pump prototype that we worked with Smiths Medical on developing. And basically the intent of this, what we call low-fidelity usability testing, it's low-fidelity because this isn't a fully functional prototype. It's a prototype that emulates part of the functionality, and it's prior to a fully functional product. So it's still in the development phase. So the purpose of this type of test is to get feedback early on to the manufacturer around what the user's expectations are, how well the system matches their expectations and their workflow. And in that way, we can refine the prototype and retest with end users. So it's very iterative. Once we get to closer to completion with a particular product or system or intervention or environment, we'll conduct what we call high fidelity simulations in order to predict how well they would perform in the real world. So we can move to the next slide. So what we do is we typically mock up the clinical environment where this system would be used, and we would script realistic scenarios and often include actors or patients, mannequins in the scenarios so that we can progress them in a realistic manner. You can move to the next slide. Here is a mock-up of an emergency department waiting room. And so we're not only interested in the interaction with the user and the system, but the user and the other people in that environment and the other aspects of the environment, such as space and things like that. Here, incidentally, in this picture, you can also see the dark one-way glass. And previously, you saw people sitting behind that one-way glass observing. So that's where we would observe the scenarios unfold and be able to objectively collect data on performance, so how well the system was meeting the user's needs. Finally, you can see that this is the interior of a helicopter where we created in our labs to test this portable stretcher-mounted ICU to be used by U.S. military medics while flying soldiers back to base hospitals. So we actually, again, because we wanted to predict actual performance in the real world, we want to simulate as closely as possible those conditions. So we built the interior of the helicopter so that we would be constrained similarly with space. We would have the same noise and lighting effects, so we would have to, one of our scenarios included flying in stealth mode when all the lights had to go down. So in this way, we were able to understand the limitations and the benefits of each of these systems. We can move on to the next slide. Because when we're testing designs in these environments, what we're trying to do is also identify residual risks so that we can mitigate them. But all mitigation strategies are not equal. There are some approaches that are more effective than others. And ISMP has developed a hierarchy of effectiveness for strategies to limit error. And the least effective strategies, those at the bottom of the hierarchy, include things like training, education, and policies and procedures. And this might seem counterintuitive because we often hear that when things go wrong, we need more training or we needed more education or we need a new policy. But in fact, those strategies are not that effective because they rely on our memory, which we know is limited. And it takes quite an effort to move. I talked about short-term memory and the limitations of short-term memory, but it takes quite an effort to move from short-term memory into long-term memory. So unless there is some emotional connection to this information, it's going to be difficult to remember. Higher up on the hierarchy of effectiveness are things like checklists and double checks. But we saw, because they are in fact memory aids, but we saw with the Denise Melanson case that the double checks can be subject to biases such as the in-group bias. And checklists are actually often quite easy to disengage from. So moving up, simplification and standardization is more effective. So if we had standardized, for example, on one pump on that floor where Denise was receiving her chemotherapy and just had the one-hour rate pump, not the 24-hour pump as well, we could have also simplified the label. We wouldn't have needed as much information on that label, the 24-hour rate or the 1 hour and the 1 hour rate. So that could have prevented that incident. It could potentially have closed that hole in the Swiss cheese. Higher up on the hierarchy of effectiveness are things like automation and computerization. So essentially what this is doing is removing the human and all of our limitations from the equation. But one of the things we need to be careful of with automation and computerization is that we're not just transferring the errors upstream or downstream to where humans are involved. And finally, at the top of the hierarchy are what we call forcing functions, which, as the name implies, limits people from performing unsafe actions. So they force us to perform safe actions. And in the real world, for example, we know that we can't accidentally reverse our cars because we need to have our foot on the brake. So that requirement to have our foot on the brake is a forcing function that keeps us from inadvertently reversing. So it keeps us safe from that standpoint. And similarly, we have forcing functions in healthcare which prevent the connection of certain gases to tanks in the OR, for example. But we have to be very careful when we're designing forcing functions in healthcare because we want to make sure that they're appropriate and they are still able to accommodate all the possible contexts in which a system might be used. So we don't want to prevent something from happening that may at times need to happen. So next slide. So really human factors, to sum everything up, is this science where we look for people to propose solutions and then use our understanding of people's capabilities as well as limitations and use that to design systems that conform to people versus the other way around. So moving on now to hand hygiene. I'll just start by talking about Ignaz Semmelweis for a few minutes because I think his story is interesting in that it really reflects some of the challenges that we still face today in hand hygiene. So Ignaz Semmelweis, as many of you know, was a Hungarian physician practicing at the Vienna General Hospital in Austria when he discovered that at his hospital, the incidence of childbed or puerperal fever were quite a lot higher than those of surrounding hospitals. And he also realized that at his hospital, babies were being delivered by physicians, where at other hospitals, they were being delivered by midwives. At his hospital, they were being delivered by physicians who were often called up from, called away from the autopsies that they were performing in the morgue to deliver their babies. And so he hypothesized that potentially the fever was linked to a lack of cleanliness. And so he tested that hypothesis by introducing a hand-washing program with chlorinated lime solution. And the incidence of puerperal fever went down from 10% to 1%. So he essentially proved that his hypothesis. But he was basically harassed by the medical community in Vienna and basically ignored, so much so that he moved back to Budapest. And, you know, he continued to try to prove his hypothesis in other ways and was met with general indifference in the medical community. So he began writing letters to prominent European obstetricians and escalating levels of concern to the point where he started to denounce them as irresponsible and as murderers. And as you can imagine, this didn't go over too well with his contemporaries, and including his wife. They all believed that he was losing his mind. And so, in fact, he was committed to a mental asylum in 1865, and he died 14 days later. And it was thought that it was because he was severely beaten by guards. Now, Semmelweis's practice did finally earn widespread acceptance years after his death when Louis Pasteur developed the germ theory of disease. But what's frustrating is that he proved that hand washing was an effective way of reducing hospital acquired infections 150 years ago. And if we move to the next slide, yet the World Health Organization still estimates that 5 to 10% of patients admitted into hospitals contract at least one hospital-acquired infection. Next slide. In the United States, this translates to 90,000 deaths from hospital-acquired infections. And that's 90,000 deaths, but it's also 2 million occurrences at a cost of $6.7 billion to the U.S. healthcare system. Next slide. Research also shows that 20 to 30% of healthcare workers at any one time are colonized with MRSA. And yet, next slide, we still are hovering around a 40% compliance rate with best practice guidelines. Next slide. So when I'm referring to compliance, what I'm referring to is with guidelines such as this one developed by the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, which describes the four moments for hand hygiene, and they are before initial patient or patient environment contact, before an aseptic procedure, after bodily fluid exposure risk, and after patient or patient environment contact. Now, the Ontario Ministry of Health is not the only, obviously, jurisdiction to put forward guidelines for the practice of hand hygiene. Go to the next slide. This slide is a little bit dated, but you can see that pretty much the entire world has committed to addressing hospital-acquired infections through improved hand hygiene campaigns, education campaigns, and auditing campaigns. So, you know, there are multiple approaches to achieving this goal of better compliance. And next slide. Our approach, as I mentioned, was complementary to these in that we wanted to identify barriers to hand hygiene and enablers so that we could focus on supportive environments and processes rather than education or auditing, which are important, obviously. Okay, so moving on to the next slide. We started our project with a review of the literature. And this is one of the things that we found. This is a modified version of O'Boyle's theory of planned behavior, in which the performance of hand hygiene is essentially influenced by two factors. One is the intention to perform hand hygiene, so you have to want to perform hand hygiene if you're going to perform it. And secondly, you have to be able to perform hand hygiene, so that's the intensity of activity. So the intention to perform hand hygiene is, in fact, mediated by three factors. The first is the belief that hand hygiene is going to be effective in reducing hospital-acquired infections. And we know that that is influenced by education and knowledge. The second motivating factor with respect to the intention to perform hand hygiene is social pressure. If we know that if there are respected others that perform hand hygiene in an environment, there will be a greater intention to perform hand hygiene. And finally, the third factor influencing the intention to perform hand hygiene is this perception of how easy it is to do hand hygiene activities, to add hand hygiene activities into the workflow. And what we hypothesized is that perception of ease of adding hand hygiene into the workflow could be mediated by the design of the environment and the design of processes that healthcare workers engage in. And similarly, the intensity of that activity, which is also a factor influencing hand hygiene performance, we hypothesize that if the design of the environment and the design of the processes could affect how busy a healthcare worker was and thus then influence their ability to perform hand hygiene. So this study really then focused on those two aspects, the design of the environment and the design of the processes, recognizing that there were other motivators such as the social pressure that, or education, for example, that we didn't touch upon in this study. So again, using that user-centered methodology, we started with a lit review, as I just discussed, but also then field studies. And we did extensive field studies in diverse clinical environments with diverse staff. So we looked at a busy med-surg ICU intensive care unit, a downtown emergency department, a family medicine clinic, and a long-term care rehab unit. And we watched and interviewed nurses, physicians, allied health professionals, personal support workers, and housekeepers. And finally, in addition to observing them and interviewing them in their environments of practice, we also ran focus groups. So I'll just share with you some of the things that we found while we were doing our observations. So the first one was that we found that often hand hygiene products look the same, even though they perform different, they were meant to perform different functions, and they were placed inconsistently. So here you see a soap dispenser that looks virtually identical to an alcohol-based hand sanitizer dispenser. And even if you, and basically the only things to differentiate the two were the brand names, not even in fact the products. But if you were then to figure out that soap was always on the right, you would be wrong because you moved to the next sink and soap was on the left. So inconsistent product placement and look-alike products was confusing and contributed to a barrier to use. We also know that the best practices call for hand hygiene upon entering a patient environment, and yet we had sinks at the back of the room. Moving on to the next slide, we had rooms without sinks in them. Moving on to the next slide, even when there were hand hygiene products, because of overcrowding, they were often inaccessible. And moving on to the next slide, even those that were accessible were sometimes inaccessible because, you know, healthcare workers don't often enter rooms, patient rooms with empty hands, especially an isolation room. And then here's, moving on to the next slide, another picture where, you know, you may want to don gloves as part of hand hygiene policy, but if they're not available in your size, so there's no large here, you're not able to. So that's another barrier. So those are some examples of barriers. And moving on to the next slide, what we did next was we mapped out As part of our observations, we mapped out a number of different workflows for a number of different healthcare workers to understand what, in fact, what activities they were performing that required hand hygiene and what the specific barriers were for each of those activities. So this is an example, and I'm sorry that it might be difficult to read. It's rather small. But this is an example of a urine sample collection task. So there are a number of activities that happen prior to entering the patient room, including potentially gowning up if it's an isolation room. And then once inside the room, there are a number of activities that could take place, for example, the administration of medications, the taking of vitals. The task that we're concerned with here is picking up the urine sample. And then leaving the room, degowning if it was an isolation room, and then printing off labels for that sample, and then finally dropping that sample off in the dirty utility room. Now, what we did then was identify all the moments required by the best practices for hand hygiene, and there were five, one upon entering the room, one upon prior to patient contact, one after exposure to bodily fluids, another after the leaving of the room, and another after dropping off the sample in the dirty utility room. So for that task of picking up a urine sample, there were five times when the healthcare worker was meant to wash their hands in order to adhere to best practices. So then what we did for each of those moments, each of those five moments of hand hygiene required for that task, we mapped, and this is the next slide, we mapped all the barriers. And again, sorry that this is difficult to read. But you can see that the barriers are listed, are prefixed by P, which indicates that there was a process barrier there, A, which indicates there was an attitudinal barrier, and E, which indicates that there was an environmental barrier. So we categorized all these barriers, and then we used our focus groups to vet those barriers, to understand the relative importance of those barriers, to actually understand whether they were, in fact, barriers, and then to come up and co-create solutions to these barriers with the actual end users in the environment. So even though, like going back to Semmelweis, even though Semmelweis was a physician who was, you know, trying to inform his colleagues of a potential beneficial change in practice, he wasn't well received, partly because probably at the time he was seen as an outsider being Hungarian in Austria. So what we wanted to do was really not be seen as outsiders, but really seen as collaborators. So that's why, again, with this technique, we involved the people that we were designing for in the design of solutions. So if we look at the next slide with the soap dispenser, we actually came to the design of the label, the hand soap label, in terms of the shape and the color and even the wording, through the application of design principles, but also understanding what healthcare workers associated with colors that healthcare workers associated soap with. So that's how we came to the pink. Incidentally, just wanted to mention that the manufacturer of this particular soap dispenser has now also come up with labels similar to what we designed in order to better cue healthcare workers as to the contents of the dispenser, which is great news. Moving on, one of the things that we did with all of the environments that we looked at was something called a heuristic evaluation. And heuristics are essentially rules of thumb for good design. So there are commonly held principles such as visibility, accessibility, efficiency, flexibility that determine how appropriate and how well a design will perform. So here, for example, you might see on the left-hand side that drawer is, in fact, labeled gloves, so there is some visibility there. But we improved the visibility of the system by taking the boxes out of the drawer, putting them on the walls, and also making them more accessible. So we improved the accessibility. Moving on, in the family medicine clinic, one of the things that we, again, thinking about the usability heuristics that we applied, but also thinking about the workflow, it didn't really make sense to us that you would have both a soap and an alcohol-based hand rub by the sink, because you would use them exclusively. You would either use soap and water or you would use the hand rub. So moving on to the next slide, it made more sense for us to mount the gloves next to the sink because you would potentially use them prior to or after putting on gloves, donning gloves. So we improved the availability and the efficiency of a workflow here with this change. Now, all of these changes were proposed. We made these changes as proposals, and then we validated them. So just moving on quickly through these next slides, this is an example of a quad room in our ED before we made any changes, and then the next slide is after where we've mounted the gloves and the alcohol-based hand rub. This next slide with the sanitizer dispenser was an interesting solution that we came up with collaboratively that I just wanted to mention. Now, not all of our solutions were in fact validated, and this was one of them that was not, but I'll tell you why we decided to do this. We noticed that, well, we wanted users to be able to use the hand sanitizer for 15 seconds. Again, best practice guidelines describe the use of hand sanitizer for 15 seconds in order to get address the total surface area of the hand. So you need to rub your hands with the alcohol-based hand rub for 15 seconds. And we saw that that wasn't happening, except when we were looking at people washing their hands in the washrooms. They tended to spend longer washing their hands when they were looking at themselves in the mirror. So we decided that we would put mirrors above these alcohol-based hand sanitizer dispensers in the halls. In fact, when we went back and we validated through surveys whether this was actually beneficial, whether these hand sanitizer dispensers were used more than other hand sanitizer dispensers, we found that in reality, the truth is people like to look at themselves, just not in front of other people in busy public patient care areas. So, in fact, this was an attempt to improve the use of the system or the compliance, but it, in fact, didn't pan out. Similarly, we looked at the refilling process on the next slide, and one of the things that we found was that this tab, this red tab, which was meant to indicate that the dispenser was empty, wasn't very salient. It wasn't very obvious that that's what it meant. So we modified that tab with an additional flag that actually said it's empty, and for refill, call page this number. When we actually implemented this, what we found was that that wasn't actually enough. We needed to actually clearly have a process in place and communicate that process to everybody so that they would know if they flipped up the flag, how long would it take for somebody to come and refill it. And in fact, the flags themselves were also found to still be too small. So next slide. Part of our validation work was to take rooms, such as this rehab quad room, where you can see that there was just one hand sanitizer outside of the room, one waste bin inside of the room, one sharps container inside of the room, and then augment it on the next slide with many more hand hygiene products in order to identify optimal locations. So here we added 13 additional hand hygiene dispensers with counters on them so we could determine the rates of use over the course of 4 weeks. So these had so we could just collect the count data from each of the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. And what the count data revealed was that the alcohol-based hand sanitizers placed outside of the room were the most frequently used, and that perhaps is not surprising since many more people are in the hallways versus in the rooms. But what was interesting was that even amongst similar units or in the same unit, there was no consensus on where the optimal locations for products were inside of the rooms. So our surveys indicated that physicians and nurses often disagreed on their preferred location of products, likely due to their different workflows. So we saw different preferences across different locations as well. But there was universal consensus on certain locations. For example, alcohol-based hand sanitizers should be placed at specimen drop-off and pneumatic tube and blood analysis machine locations. So we were able to validate certain locations, but others we understood ended up being really determined by the workflow and the people in those environments. So there was no simple answer, was the finding. Next slide. So what we did then was think about how to roll up all of these findings in a toolkit that would be appropriate for use by healthcare workers to optimize their environments, given that our study showed that really each environment is quite different depending on who works in it. So what we did was we included four sub-tools, an initial environment assessment tool, which allowed us to take stock of what was happening in the current environment, a product selection tool which described how to get staff involved in the procurement of tools that were appropriate for them, and also, for example, to get them involved in the design of labels. We had a process tool which focused on the maintenance of the hand hygiene products to make sure that they were always available and always full, et cetera. And then an ongoing assessment tool to ensure that the approaches to hand hygiene optimization were maintained. So this initial assessment tool actually is the crux of the toolkit, and it contains many of the guidelines that we used during our modification study, but they're adaptable. And so that they are guidelines that are underpinned with human factors facts so that there's rationale for each of those guidelines. And the intent then is that clinicians can work through the toolkit, understand the intent of each of those guidelines, and then modify those guidelines as appropriate. The toolkit, next slide, was reviewed by 10 different institutions to ensure that the content was correct. And this is sort of keeping in with the iterative design process that is central to user-centered design. And then we also, next slide, engaged industrial design students from the Ontario College of Art and Design to help us create a form for the toolkit so that it would be easily and willingly used by busy healthcare workers, recognizing that this is another thing we were asking them to do on top of everything else, so assess their environment and optimize their environment. So these are some of the designs on the next slide that were put forth by the students from the Ontario College of Art and Design. The toolkit is now available from the Safer Healthcare Now website on the next slide. And just to give you an example of one of the tools and how that works. We have an activity and how it sort of speaks to the need for customization for particular environments. We have an activity in the toolkit which we call the sticker placement activity, where the toolkit contains different colored stickers that represent all the different types of hand hygiene products. So there's a particular color for soap, a particular color for gloves, a particular color for waste receptacles, a particular color for sinks, etc. And the idea is that healthcare workers take these stickers with them while they're going about their daily activities. And when they find that they're in need of a particular hand hygiene product that's unavailable, they use the appropriate colored sticker to identify where they would like that product to be placed. And we actually tested this as part of our research and development of the toolkit and found that there was an extremely high correlation with these clusters of dots to the optimal locations once we surveyed users on those placements. So what we did was we looked at the clusters of dots. We actually installed the appropriate products where those clusters were most dense, and then after a period of time, we surveyed users on their impressions of the ease of performing hand hygiene in these modified environments, and found that not only did they perceive that it was easier to perform hand hygiene, but their performance of hand hygiene, as evidenced through our auditing, actually increased. So that tool was a very effective tool for optimizing a particular environment, and it's included in the toolkit. So my final slide is just a slide of acknowledgement. The study that we performed, this one that I described here on hand hygiene, was funded by the Canadian Patient Safety Institute, and we had input from a number of staff as well as reviewers at the institutions that I indicated, and this class of industrial design students from the Ontario College of Art and Design. And the last slide there is just contact information, where you can learn more about healthcare human factors, the projects that we're currently engaged in.
Andrew, thank you so much for that lovely presentation. I had the pleasure of hearing it actually at the CHICA meeting in Vancouver last year, and it was one of the more memorable sessions, or of an excellent meeting. But I'll be right in thinking that the large resources that you have available, such as the labs and the observational areas, are not essential to the principles of a human factors approach, and that in parts of the world with limited resources, this approach still could pay dividends.
Yes, that's exactly right, Martin. Just to reiterate, those principles that underpin each of those guidelines are applicable, I think, regardless. They are commonly held principles of ergonomics and good design that speak to improving the visibility, the accessibility, the efficiency of environments to support hand hygiene.
And I think your sticker project neatly showed the vital importance of getting users involved right at the beginning, because sometimes I feel experts do things for users instead of involving the users in the early stage, and that's why they don't pan out as we think. Thank you so much, Andrew. I was also quite impressed with the synopsis you gave of Dr. Semmelweis's work. And if I may give just a brief plug for anybody who's ever visiting the beautiful city of Budapest, it's well worth a visit to the Semmelweis Museum, which is a small museum dedicated to the life and work of Dr. Semmelweis, run by volunteers. Very moving museum to visit. All of his original work is there, and he's actually buried in the courtyard there. So if anybody's ever visiting Budapest, I would really recommend that. It only remains for me now to thank Anjum for a lovely presentation, and to thank our sponsors for today, which are Deb Limited. I hope you have enjoyed the session. If you wish to hear it again, it is available on the Webus Training website, and I hope you all have a good afternoon. Thank you very much.